Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the broadcast today, Edward Snowden and global trade. Really? The economic virtues of local television also. Really? And the secret to author James Patterson's success. Just write what people want to read. Really? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the first day of July. This is the Marketplace podcast. Good to have you with us. This is, by the way, day 8 of Edward Snowden's extended stay at Moscow Sheremetyevo Airport. He's apparently looking to stay in Russia for a while as well. Mr. Snowden applied for political asylum there last night. Meanwhile, Der Spiegel, the German news magazine, has published another batch of NSA documents that Snowden has admitted leaking, and they have touched a raw nerve in several European capitals, allegations that the U.S. has been bugging dozens of foreign embassies. They are none too happy about that in Berlin and Brussels, and especially Paris, where French President François Hollande says the revelations could threaten the planned multi-billion-dollar U.S.-EU free trade deal. Really? From the European desk in London Marketplace's Stephen Beard gets us going.
The anger seems genuine. Politicians across Europe appear to be hopping mad. Guy Verhofstadt is a leading member of the European Parliament. He says bugging, hacking and eavesdropping, you don't do that to your friends.
Normally you do it with the Russians, like in the past. You do it with the Chinese, you do it with the North Koreans, you name it, but not between friends.
Europe's been betrayed, said the French President François Hollande. And unless America guarantees the spying has stopped, Europe should pull out of the EU-US trade pact. Could the deal be in jeopardy? Trade attorney Jim Killick.
Well, I think there's so much positive benefit to be gained by both sides in economic terms that I'd be very surprised if the talks just stopped now.
The free trade deal could generate $600 billion a year and create more than 1 million new jobs in both the US and in Europe. Is a spy scandal really going to put that at risk?
In the big scheme of things, I don't think this should disrupt the talks.
Indeed, some question whether the European anger over Snowden's revelations is genuine. Sir Christopher Mayer is a former British ambassador.
I suspect that in Paris and in Berlin, if you dug very, very deeply to find out what their intelligence services were up to, you might come up with revelations as exciting as those as Edward Snowden has revealed to Der Spiegel.
The European anger may be for public consumption. It may be designed to wrong-foot the US ahead of the trade talks, but the talks seem likely to go ahead. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Today's corporate news comes to us courtesy of the Tribune Company. No, it's not news of bankruptcy, from which Tribune emerged just 6 months ago. Nor is it news of Tribune selling off its flagship newspapers, the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, about which there has been much speculation of late. No, today Tribune bought itself a whole bunch of television time, a $2.7 billion deal for all 19 stations owned by a company called Local TV. It would make Tribune the biggest commercial television station owner in the country. Now, why, might you wonder, invest in old media like local television? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports there is a new media twist to this story.
The deal would give Tribune top stations in markets like Denver and Cleveland. TV is big business these days. Last month, Gannett made an offer for 20 local stations, and media giant Sinclair has been acquiring them as well. Rick Edmonds is a media analyst with the Poynter Institute.
The business has really done very well, especially in an election year like last year.
And stations have a more regular source of revenue now, says Edmonds.
So-called retransmission fees, and basically that's the cable companies paying the local stations for the right to carry them.
Retransmission fees are expected to bring in about $3 billion this year. Of course, TV is struggling with its role in the digital age and declining audiences, just like newspapers are. And to deal with that, bigger is better, says media analyst Ken Doctor.
The ability to offer national advertisers better packages helps them on the sales end.
Selling ads across TV stations and newspapers, it will also give Tribune more bargaining power to squeeze higher fees out of cable TV operators, says Doctor.
What it gives them is really scale. Scale buys time.
Time to figure out how to make money in the evolving media industry, where things change fast. Just a few years ago, TV stations weren't such hot properties. The stations the Tribune plans to buy were all sold off by the New York Times Company in 2006. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I heard a trader say this on CNBC this afternoon right at the closing bell, quote, "I'm looking to buy in the second half of the year." And that, come to think of it, was kind of the mood on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been a little more than a month since Moore, Oklahoma was hit by that enormous tornado. 23 people were killed, many more injured, and homes and businesses destroyed by the dozens. Among them, a company called Ideal Hearing Solutions, Ms. Gay Dawn McGee, proprietor. We talked to her a couple of days after that tornado, and we've gotten her back on the line to see how she and her business are doing. Ms. McGee, it's good to have you back with us.
Hi, good to be here.
How goes it?
It's going.
Okay. Is it going well or not so well?
Maybe not so well.
Last time we spoke to you, it was maybe 3-4 days after the tornado. You had been heading out of town. You got back in and you dug in to work. How goes that process for you of rebuilding your business that you promised to do?
Well, I applied for a small business disaster loan, but mm-hmm. It looks like that is only to, like, pick up the difference between what the insurance would pay and, you know, what the physical damage was.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, my business is so new, it really is still on working capital. So basically, I don't qualify. And then the regular SBA loan, they called me back yesterday saying, well, unless you have money to put down to go with the SBA loan, you're probably not going to qualify under us either. So, you know, I'm kind of in between.
What are you going to do? Because this sounds, it sounds like you're not any better off now than you were 3 days after the tornado hit.
Well, work-wise, you know, I may be completely out of luck in being able to reopen my office. Without the funding, you know, like I said, I put everything I had into it, and I'm putting my house up for sale next week because, obviously,
to put into the business or to.
Well, no, I just live way within my means. I don't have credit cards. I don't do anything. So when I made really good money, I had a big house, and mm-hmm. you know, all the stuff that goes with that. And when I don't make really good money, all that stuff has to go away.
What happens, Ms. McGee, to your business if you don't get a loan, if the SBA doesn't come through, if you can't get the money?
Then it's gone. I have to just go get a job. So,
what are the job prospects, though, for a down-on-your-luck hearing aid specialist?
You know, I don't know, but, you know, I can do a lot of things. I actually am a pilot. I used to be an instructor pilot. I used to be a real estate broker. I've done a lot of things in my life. I'm fairly intelligent. And, you know, at one point, not too long ago, I had a conversation with my mom that if I lost everything and my kids were okay, then that would be fine with me.
Yep.
And every now and then, I think you have to put your money where your mouth is.
Fair enough. Gay Dawn McGee runs, or used to run, I guess, Ideal Hearing Solutions in Moore, Oklahoma. Her business was destroyed in that tornado about a month ago. Ms. McGee, thanks very much for your time, man.
All righty. You're welcome.
We've been following a couple of people from Moore, how they're getting by since that tornado hit, before and after pictures and the audio as well at marketplace.org. It's helpful to remember that those economic statistics we hit you with from time to time don't exist in a vacuum. There is always more to the story than just inflation was up 0.1%, or for our purposes today, housing starts. New home construction was up almost 7% last month. All those new houses don't build themselves, you know. You got to clear the land, pour a foundation, and then get a bunch of lumber to frame it out. And the slow but steady rise in housing starts is welcome news for sawmills that got clobbered during the housing bust. From Red River Radio, Kate Archer Kent visits the biggest plywood plant in North America for a closer read on lumber supply and demand.
This plywood plant in Chopin, Louisiana, produces enough lumber to build 15,000 homes a year. Inside the plant, a giant lathe skins the bark off a tree and whittles it down to the size of a fence post in seconds. It's just one piece of big, ominous equipment in a factory that spans 18 acres under roof.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
Roy O'Martin is a family-owned wood products manufacturer that's been in business for 90 years. Chief Operating Officer Scott Poole says many lumber mills went dark during the Great Recession as the housing market collapsed.
It wasn't a trickle down, it was a fall off the cliff. It was a mad race to try to match usage with production, and as a result, a lot of the mills closed permanently.
Now some of these shuttered mills are being bought up and reopened.
How you doing?
Nice to meet you.
Louisiana is half forest. In the heart of it is the tiny town of Urania. Its elders are affectionately called knotheads. The town lost its plywood mill in 2002. Now a German wood pellet maker is moving in and promising hundreds of new jobs. One of those knotheads, Mayor Terry Corley, says residents had to move away to find work. Many went to offshore oil rigs, and it nearly killed the town.
If someone had told me when LP closed that we would still be a town 13 years later, I would have never believed it. God has blessed us so much, we can't ask for more.
Back at the Chopin plywood plant, many workers are bused in from nearby towns, a benefit that's subsidized by Roy O'Martin. The company can find plant workers, but getting enough log trucks in each day is tough. Loggers retired in droves during the housing collapse. New workers are not getting into forestry because it takes several million dollars to get up and running. Poole says it's hard to take on new risk in a wishy-washy economy.
Do I want to go spend $500,000 for this new piece of equipment and spend the next 5 years trying to pay it off when I'm at an age where I'd like to retire?
Poole is okay with new risk. He'll be adding at least 24 new workers to this plant of more than 700 and paying for more machinery that's on order. What he wants is for more stability.
From the home buyers to the banks to the other manufacturers in this business, we need a level of discipline that can sustain slow, solid growth instead of these knee-jerk reactive markets.
The Chopin plant is in the midst of a $20 million expansion to produce more 4x4s for the housing market. That new production line should be running by this time next year. In Chopin, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer Kent for Marketplace.
Coming up, the business of writing bestsellers.
Simon and Garfunkel, Lennon, McCartney. You know what I mean? It's done a lot. And then people go, oh, okay, yeah, I guess it isn't that big a deal.
Author James Patterson straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The happy music, quite literally, was playing on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials drummed up 65 points, 0.4%, closed at 14,974. The NASDAQ hummed a pleasant tune, ended things up 31 points, 0.9%, finished things at 3434. The S&P 500 ended up 8 points, that's about 0.5%, finished at 1614. Wall Street's melody today came in the form of a Steinway grand piano. Private equity firm Kohlberg & Company agreed to buy 160-year-old Steinway musical instruments for 438 million simoleons. Investors were, wait for it, tickled. They were tickled. Steinway stock jumped 16% today. Kohlberg stock up about 0.5% or so. Bond prices rose slightly. The yield on the 10-year slipped to 2.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org. From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday.
In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for May. Anyone finish out June with a new car? Automakers are scheduled to report monthly sales. And cue the big band. On July 2nd, 1955, the Lawrence Welk Show premiered on TV. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. 48 hours. That's how long the Egyptian army is going to give President Mohamed Morsi to sort out the crisis that has again brought people into the streets there. The protests are about a couple of things: lack of security, a lack of faith in President Morsi, and a lack of faith in the Egyptian economy. The chaos of the past 2 years has been rough for a country that relies so heavily on tourism, and it's been rough on the businesses that need that tourism, too. Imad Nuhafez owns a gift shop in the famous Khan el-Khalili Bazaar in Cairo. It is touristy stuff, mostly. Mr. Hafez, thanks for joining us.
I'm very happy to speaking with you in your program.
Good. So tell me, sir, how is business today? How are the crowds? Are you selling anything?
Yeah, as a business in Egypt now, not so well.
Do you think it will be a good thing, then, if the military does what it said it was going to do and take over in 48 hours or so?
I think it is not good. It is best. It is best for us, you know, because we have a little bit of troubles, you know. We have a little bit of a bad situation, but we're moving to the good point, you know.
Yeah, but are any of those people who are in Cairo today, are any of those people who are protesting, are they coming to buy things at your store? Are you selling anything? Can you stay in business if this keeps going?
You know, that is a bad point in this situation. You know, business not very well in this time, you know. Egypt is a big tourist market, you know.
Yeah.
What happened in Egypt in this last two years, you know, makes the tourists not come to Egypt, you know. But it's okay. We'll be okay.
Yes, but you have a small family business there in Cairo, Mr. Hafez, and how much longer can you be patient? How much longer can you wait for the tourists to come back? Because it looks very scary now.
We are patient for 2 years now, my friend. 2 years we are so patient. So we can waiting just 2 or 3 months more, you know. We believe in army. We believe in army, and we trusted them so much, and we trusted this man in the army, Mr. Sisi, you know, General Sisi. He is the best man. He is the best man. I think everything moving well in Egypt now, and we'll do everything so well.
What happens, sir, if in 6 months it's still a mess and it's still a problem?
You know, our life depends on the tourist. Our life, you know, our family, our kids, everyone in our family need tourists. That is our life, my friend. We are a big country for tourists, you know?
Yeah.
What happened in two years ago? No tourists come to Egypt. How we live?
Well, Mr. Hafez, thank you very much, and good luck to you, sir.
It's okay. More than welcome, my friend.
Much of the western part of the country has been just hot the past couple of days. Records or near records in dozens of cities. Even places where they're used to extreme heat have been struggling. People and businesses alike. In Phoenix, Arizona this weekend, U.S. Airways canceled 18 flights because, and I'm not making this up, it was too hot to fly. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark has more now on what just a couple of extra degrees can mean for infrastructure and the American economy.
Let's start with those flights down in Phoenix. Todd Leemacher, a former pilot and U.S. Airways spokesman, says they had to cancel them because the temperature was off the charts. Literally, the charts that calculate flight data only go up to 118 degrees. On Saturday, it was 119.
And since the charts don't go up that high, we couldn't accurately calculate, for instance, the runway distance required for the takeoff at that temperature.
The hotter the air, the less lift the wings have, so the distance gets longer. If higher temperatures are the new normal, the airline could ask plane manufacturers to make the charts go higher, but that would cost a lot of money.
That's something that we have to evaluate. We have to do a cost evaluation and see if that's something that we need to.
In the nuclear industry, some plants have already had to make adjustments. Since 1999, Pine, a plant in Illinois, has had to put in two requests to increase the temperature limits on their cooling ponds. Krista Lopakinski is with Exelon, which operates the plant. First, they had to check if pond water could be hotter than 98 degrees, then 100.
In the report, it refers to meteorological conditions, but basically the water was getting warmer.
When highways get warmer, there are other issues. Paving sections can expand and buckle. Todd Scullion is an engineer at the Texas Transportation Institute. He says roads are designed to withstand the average of the 10 hottest days you can expect in a year. But that average might be changing.
If it's an average over the last 50 years, well, that might not be appropriate anymore.
If extreme temperatures become the new normal, that could blow up the old calculations and raise costs. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Take Dan Brown, the guy who wrote The Da Vinci Code, and Stephen King and John Grisham, and roll them all up into one. And together, they still don't sell as many books as the guy you're about to hear from. It's quite likely you know James Patterson's best, for his thrillers. But he does romance novels and books for young adults and nonfiction as well, sometimes with co-authors, sometimes by himself. So today on our occasional series, The Art of Money, the industry that is James Patterson. Exhibit A, he had two books published on the same day last week, a thriller for grown-ups and a book on the horrors of summer camp for young adults. Mr. Patterson, it's good to have you with us, sir.
Good to be here.
So as I was mulling over the list of questions I wanted to start with, there are like a zillion of them, I kept coming back to this. Don't you get tired with this output and the industry you have built?
I don't think about an industry or building things, but somebody said you're lucky if you find something you like to do, and then which is true, and then it's a miracle if somebody will pay you to do it. and that's my deal. I love to do it. I love to tell stories. Take storytelling out of my life, and there's a big hole in the center. So, no, I don't get tired of it at all.
When did you realize that in order to keep producing at the volume you produce, you had to get co-authors in and collaborate with people?
A friend of mine, we were playing a little golf, and he's a good writer. And I tell him this story idea I had for this little golf novel. And we agreed we'd sort of try it ourselves. And it turned out great. And, you know, if you think about it, out there in Hollywood, most of the TV shows, it's a couple of writers.
Yeah.
And then you start going, okay, Simon and Garfunkel, Lennon, McCartney, Woodward and Bernstein. You know what I mean? It's done a lot.
Yeah.
And then people go, oh, okay, yeah, I guess it isn't that big a deal.
Are you going to write till you can't write anymore?
Yeah. Yeah, and I hope that doesn't happen either. I mean, I'd like to, fall over at my desk at, 97, you know.
90,
when I get to be 97, good. I'll go 103, whatever it is.
How do you feel about e-books, by the way?
Terrific. The only issue with e-books for me, and it's not e-books per se, it's that this phenomena has come on so quickly, and the ramifications are pretty serious, and I don't think anybody's had time to think them out and figure out, okay, what are we going to do with less bookstores? With respect to parents in most of these houses, they haven't come to grips with, okay, how many e-readers should we have in the house, and what are we going to do about the kids having e-books? Now, with my adult books, for the first 6 weeks or so, it's about 60% e-books in terms of sales.
Wow.
The kids' books, it's like 5%.
Yeah.
Which means that the parents, you know, the ones who aren't going into stores now are not – they're no longer buying books for their kids, which is not great.
I'm a little surprised you didn't give me the I like the tangible feel of a book in my hands answer, too.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I like both. You know, if I'm going on a trip, man, there's nothing like being able to carry around seven books and it weighs 11 ounces.
This is going to sound a little sideways, and I'll preface it.
Excellent.
Well, you know, we'll see how this goes over. You are the most normal sounding big shot that I've ever talked to, and so that was running through my mind as you were talking a minute ago. Not that I wasn't listening to you, but I wonder what it's like when you are this big shot
dealing with people's perceptions of you? And I ask because, you know, a lot of people say your writing is just airplane fodder and this and that. And I know you've said you don't care about that. But how do you deal with those perceptions?
Well, you care. You care to, up to a point. You just want people to be semi-reasonable. Look, I think it's crazy that people get big heads about themselves. I don't get it. I won't hang around. I mean, we live in Palm Beach, so theoretically there's a lot of people that have done things there. But I just won't hang with people that are you know, self-important or really impressed with it. One of my jokes about Palm Beach, I call it the city of used-to-bes. Used to be president of, used to be chairman of, used to be spouse of, the whatever. It's just not where I come from. I think part of, you know, the way I was raised with a lower middle class. So I've seen all the different stratas of society. And, you know, there's good people in all of them and not so good people in all of them. And you know, I'm certainly not impressed with myself. I'm comfortable in my own skin, but I'm not impressed with myself.
James Patterson. He's got two books, the latest in the middle school series for, I guess the market's called The Young Adults, and then a book for grown-ups called Second Honeymoon.
The one thing about the two books, it's no accident they're coming out in the same day. And that's not about marketing. What it is about is adults, please, when you're going into the store or you go online or you go into the library, remember your kids.
Yep.
Remember your kids. Because if your kids – if you don't get your kids reading – and if they're not good readers, it's like sending them out into the world with a handicap. And nobody would do that knowingly, but people do it all the time.
Mr. Patterson, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
We've got James Patterson reading the first chapter of his latest thriller, Second Honeymoon, it's called. It's up on our website right now, marketplace.org, if you want to check it out.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today about the production credits you hear every Friday on this program. They're going to be a little bit different this week because you're not going to hear me say right at the very end there, J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager around these parts. Because after 25 years at Marketplace, J.J. is leaving the company today officially. He was here at the very beginning, but calling him simply a co-founder doesn't really do it justice. He helped carve out the place this program has in your public radio day. Different kind of show with a different kind of attitude. And you might have only heard the name once a week, but I'm telling you, J.J. Yore was a part of this broadcast every single day that it was on the air. And that is it for Marketplace from APM today. The Dow up 65 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 31 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 ended up 8 points. That is 0.5%. Our producers include Lina Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.